You are listening to Natural Born Alchemist.
You're listening to episode 349 of the Natural Born Alchemist podcast, and I'm Alex, and I'll be your host. And in this episode, we're going to check out Daryl Cooper's Fear and Loathing in Jerusalem series from the Martyr Made podcast. And this series is a deep dive into the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And it tells the story from both sides. And it's very good. It's, I don't know how long it is, 20, 30 hours long. I'm not going to play all that here. Instead, I'm going to play an edit I did of the first couple of episodes, mainly from the first one. Like an hour condensed version of the whole series to give you an idea. And if you like what you hear, I highly recommend you go check out the full series because it's really good. And even though I think it's very unbiased, I still cannot comprehend how anyone, and some have, you know, but I don't understand how anyone can listen to the complete series and still not side with the Palestinians. But that's just me. Anyway, here is Fear and Loathing in Jerusalem.
I want you to close your eyes. Take a breath. And imagine you're lying in your bed. It's maybe 3 a.m., your wife's sleeping next to you. You've had a long, exhausting day of work, and you've got another one ahead of you, but you're a little anxious and having trouble sleeping. See, she's pregnant, and you're excited about it, but you're also wondering how you're going to feed a third child. Work's been tough to come by lately because more and more employers aren't looking for people like you. In fact, your family's starting to get dirty looks in a neighborhood you've lived in for years. Your kids have begun to ask why people don't seem to like us as much anymore, and your wife has to avoid certain streets because of the way some of the young men will shout at her and the other women. But just breathe. Try to relax. It was worse than this last year, and things calmed down then. They'll calm down now, right? You listen for your wife's breathing. It's deep and even. She's asleep. You've always been the worrier, but the truth is she's got a better sense of these things than you do, and she's sleeping like a baby, right? So just go to sleep. As you close your eyes and turn over, you hear some glass break in the distance outside. You feel your body tense up, but you take a deep breath. It could have been anything. Then you begin to hear the voices. Shouting. Your wife reaches for your arm and pulls herself closer to you. Shouting's unmistakable now, and there are more crashes moving down the street in the direction of your house. Tell yourself this can't be happening, not here, but even as the thoughts form, you're already out of bed and moving to the window. And that's when you see them. Outside, you see a group of people surrounding your neighbor and beating him with clubs. His children are in the street. He's in his pajamas. Their faces, they seem crazed. Your wife is out of bed and going to the kids' room. They're awake and asking what's going on. They've noticed that things have been different, but you've tried to protect them. You haven't told them what's been happening to people like you all over the country. You get your family partly dressed, but you're starting to hear people outside your front door, and there's no more time to lose. You grab your 9-year-old son and your 6-year-old daughter. You hug your wife, and the four of you are out the back door into an alley just as the mob smashes your door in. You make your way through the back alleys, and as you're going through, occasionally you're catching glimpses through the houses of your friends and their families being assaulted by people with clubs and torches and kitchen implements. People are screaming, and you see blood, and there's fire and smoke. Houses are being burned. How is this happening? You recognize some of these attackers. They're people you see every day. These aren't strangers. People you buy groceries from, people you pass on the street who fix your roof and who you've done work for. You look into your kids' eyes and they're confused and terrified. Your wife's keeping it together. She believes you're going to protect her, but you're just trying to look strong. You have no idea where to go. You run around a corner and find yourself face to face with a big man in a police uniform. Begin to tell him about the commotion on the street, about the attacks and the fires and the looks in their eyes, and you keep talking to him as if he's a policeman, even as you realize that he's raising his club and bringing it down on your head, and now everything is dark. You wake some time later in the street, with your head ringing and lying in a pool of blood. The noise and pain wake you up. You squint through a film of blood and bleary eyes, and you see four men raping your wife. She's covered with blood, and she's badly beaten. It seems only half aware of what's happening to her. She looks in your direction. Your daughter is being held by the arms by two drunken men, and your son's lying at their feet in a bloody heap. You begin to realize that there are bodies everywhere. Your neighbors. Two laughing teenagers step over a body as they come out of your house with the few valuables you had before setting fire to your home. You went to bed a few hours ago. This was just another day. You can see in your wife's eyes that some part of her still believes that you're going to save her. You struggle to find your balance and you move toward her when a teacher from the local school steps behind you and crushes your skull with a hammer. This isn't a scene from a horror movie or some singularly horrific event that occurred, you know, that one time in humanity's dark past. If you were a Jewish person living in Europe or Russia for most of the last 1,000 years, this scene would have been pretty familiar to you because it happened all the time. They were called pogroms, and this kind of anti-Jewish violence sort of came in waves throughout European and Russian history. Times of uncertainty and turmoil tended to be bad news for European Jews in general, as the anxieties of the population always seemed to get taken out on people who had been designated either by the community or by themselves as set apart or different. Usually it's a little bit of both. During the 14th century, for example, in addition to enduring the ravages of war and black plague like everyone else, Jews also had to deal with being accused by terrified Christians of being behind all the chaos, of spreading the plague through black magic or by poisoning wells. Pogroms erupted across Europe. Despite declarations from Pope Clement VI that the Jews were innocent, this was an age when the Pope's word was literally the law, it didn't matter. He was threatening to excommunicate anyone who attacked a Jew over the blood libel, didn't matter. A lot's been written about the nature and causes of anti-Semitism. We could do a whole 3-hour conversation on that topic alone, but it's not important to get into it right at this moment, except to say that anti-Jewish feeling and anti-Jewish violence had been a fact of life in Europe for a long time. Now, the late 1800s were a time of immense uncertainty as industrialization and advances in technology were causing upheaval at every level of society. And this tumultuous time was no exception to the rule I just mentioned, and anti-Semitism was rising all over the place, most of all in Eastern Europe and Russia. 3 years between 1881 and 1884 in just the Russian Empire, there were at least 200 pogroms. And the thing to understand about a pogrom is that it's not just mob violence. It's not just a riot. It's an attack with implicit or explicit sanction from the powers that be. You know, to me, maybe the scariest part of the story that I just asked you to imagine was running into the police officer and realizing that moment when you realize that he's not going to help you. Now, what the best course of action was, that was a matter for debate. But many Jews all over Europe had had enough. They'd had it. They were done leaving their well-being and their safety and the safety of their families to the goodwill of others. And so between 1881 and 1914, 2.5 million Jews would flee the Russian Empire, but they found greater or lesser degrees of anti-Semitism wherever they went. Many were fortunate enough to make it to the U.S. or Britain or France, where things were certainly easier than they were in Eastern Europe or Russia, but they were still met with suspicion and discrimination that would qualify as rank racism and horror story stuff today. Back then, it was relatively mild, but only in a relative sense. Many were embracing socialism and labor groups like the Bund. Others were finding hope or venting their frustration in radical revolutionary movements. They'd had it. They were finished waiting around for change, and they were embracing in great numbers. They were embracing movements of forceful, violent overthrow of existing orders. Jewish members formed an important part of Bolshevism and other communist groups. They played a prominent role in 19th and early 20th century anarchist movements. In addition to Bolshevism and anarchism, others began turning to an ideology of radical Jewish nationalism known as Zionism. When I say Zionist, I find that a lot of Americans, at least, get this image almost of an elderly Orthodox Jew nodding his head, you know, praying at the Wailing Wall. If that's anything like the image you get, then the first thing you need to do is get that image right out of your head. When I say Zionist in this story, you need to think of mostly young, fierce, fiery radicals drawn from the same pool of revolutionaries that will soon be putting people against the wall in communist Russia in just a few years. In fact, Zionism was competing for recruits with Bolshevism, these other radical movements. It's a competition which Winston Churchill and, you know, maybe typical Churchillian hyperbole would later call, quote, little less than a struggle for the soul of the Jewish people. Leon Trotsky, who would found and command the Soviet Red Army in the Russian Revolution. He was at the Sixth Zionist Congress and many other early meetings. And he eventually came to believe that Zionism was incompatible with the kind of revolution he had in mind. But he didn't just walk away. He actively worked to undermine the Zionist movement and attack its leaders. You see, Zionists were very aware that they were in competition with these other radical movements for the loyalty of young Jews. So forget the old doddering guy kind of, you know, moving back and forth. Forget about it. You can think of them as idealistic revolutionaries who dreamed of the liberation of their people, because there's certainly truth in that image. But if you were a Palestinian living in the first half of the 20th century and I said the word Zionist, it would conjure an image of a person who had just thrown a grenade into a crowded theater, or set fire to a mosque full of people, or sprayed machine gun fire into a midday market. Now, idealist or terrorist, these early Zionists were not just humble families looking for a place to rest their heads, but radical students and thinkers and pioneers and fighters cut from the same cloth as the people who were leading the charge to overthrow the Russian Empire and build the Soviet Union, people who were willing to do anything to create a new world on their own terms. So then this is the environment in the late 1800s, an environment of constant anti-Semitism and frequent violence, with a bunch of people who were just tired of feeling threatened and under siege. This was the feeling when in 1882, after a series of pogroms in the Russian Empire, a small group who called themselves the Biluim, Ims, plural, the group called itself Bilu, which is an acronym for a Hebrew passage, which is where most of the Zionist groups that we're going to encounter in this story will get their names. The Biluim, they issued a manifesto and put out a call to the scattered Jews of Europe. Starts out recounting some of the biblical mythology of the Hebrew people in the land of Israel, and it talks about the persecution through which the Jewish people had suffered for so many years, and then it addresses itself to the Jewish people. Quote, "This spark is again kindling and will shine for us, a true pillar of fire going before us on the road to Zion." Zion, by the way, is a hill in the city of Jerusalem. "While behind us is a pillar of cloud, the pillar of oppression threatening to destroy us. Sleepest thou, O our nation? What hast thou been doing until 1882? Sleeping and dreaming the false dream of assimilation. Now, thank God, thou art awakened from thy slothful slumber. The pogroms have awakened thee from thy charmed sleep. Thine eyes are open to recognize the cloudy, delusive hopes. Canst thou listen silently to the taunts and mockeries of thine enemies?" It goes on to explain that they intend to ask the permission of the Ottoman Empire to settle on a small strip of land on the eastern shore of the Mediterranean that the Romans had called Palestine. They intend, quote, "to beg it of the Sultan himself, and if it be impossible to obtain this, to beg that we may at least possess it as a state within a larger state, the internal administration to be ours, to have our civil and political rights, and to act within the Turkish Empire only in foreign affairs, so as to help our brother Ishmael in his time of need," end quote. And now you may have noticed something very interesting, and it's a very important point. Ignoring for the moment their somewhat confusing conflation of the Turks with the descendants of Ishmael, notice that the Arabs and the Muslims are not the enemy in 1882. The early Zionists had no beef with the Arabs native to the place we now call Israel. And the Arabs didn't concern themselves too much when the Zionists first started moving to Palestine. In 1896, Theodor Herzl, a Jewish Austrian writer, called the father of modern political Zionism, he earned that title by publishing a pamphlet that would become the founding document of the movement. It's a remarkable document for its insight and clarity, for Herzl's clear understanding of the deep forces at work in Europe and within the disparate communities of European Jews. Herzl wrote his manifesto in 1896, calling on the Jews scattered around Europe to recognize themselves as one people, one national entity, and to join him in reclaiming their ancient home in Palestine. In his document, he doesn't mention the local population really at all. One of the things you notice when you read it, and really when you go through almost all of these early documents and diary entries and speeches, is that the people, the hundreds of thousands of people currently living in the land in question, are almost literally not mentioned. Herzl had never actually been to Palestine when he wrote his pamphlet, and he refers to it as, quote, a neutral territory. He vaguely recognizes the fact that there are natives, his word. His manifesto is 24,000 or so words long, and the word Arab doesn't appear once. And he recognizes that they may resist Zionist colonization. That's another word he uses. But that's as far as it goes. His solution to the problem is to cut a deal with the Turkish government to enforce and protect Zionist settlement from any restless natives who don't like it. Now, partially this reflects just an Orientalist, colonialist view of the world, where people who live on a piece of land aren't citizens, they're not a culture or a society, they're just natives. Part of the background, along with the hills and the trees and the animals, and certainly not a meaningful political entity to be consulted about the grand decisions of civilized men. No matter where you go, the Americas, Africa, even places with built-up civilizations, Europeans of this time usually just sort of had an attitude of, you know, what, who lives there? Natives live there. The Chinese? Yeah, just natives. The Arabs have plenty of land. Just go across the river to Jordan. I mean, all we want is a little piece. And they were saying to Palestinians, you're Arab. Go live where Arabs live. Go live in Egypt or Jordan or Arabia or somewhere. Just give us this one little piece of land. What's the big deal? Why are you being so unreasonable? Now, to the typical European back then, the Zionists were all Europeans, by the way. An Arab was just an Arab. You know, think about it. The Ottoman Empire controlled the entire Middle East at this time. And so imagine you're looking at a world map, and all these countries in the Middle East that are different colors on your map, erase all the lines and cover it all with one color, with Ottoman Empire just written over the whole thing. Now, if you're a European, there's a good chance that you're not going to have any real granular understanding of all the differences within that big block. You might just have kind of a general idea that the Arabs live in this big area south of Turkey and west of Iran, but you're not going to get too detailed with it. If all of Europe had been under one big empire for centuries and centuries, and in an age before the internet or anything like that, you looked at a map, and it was just all one state. People might know the differences between Austrians and French, but are they going to be aware of the deep cultural and linguistic traditions that make French-speaking Walloon Belgians a distinct entity? Apart from France? Probably not. They're both of Frankish descent. They both speak French. What's the difference, right? Well, the Belgians and the French would tell you there's a big difference. In a similar way to the Zionists, the nuance was either lost or ignored in the lands of the Levant. An Arab was just an Arab. But of course, the locals didn't see it that way. They would be saying, hey, you know, besides the fact that this is my home and my great-great-grandfather built this house and planted these olive trees, I'm not just an Arab. I'm a Palestinian. A Palestinian is not an Egyptian. That's like telling a Frenchman, give up your home and go live in England. You're all Euro something or other. What's the difference? The inability to see individual people as people plagues this issue today on both sides, by the way. Now, throughout this story, the Western powers will treat the Arabs and the Jews differently, and mostly, honestly, it was just because of basic familiarity. The Zionists they're going to be talking to are urban Europeans, wearing suits and speaking English or French with maybe no accent, with names like Jacob or David, something that the people will recognize from the Bible. The Arabs send delegations of men whose names contain letters that they can't pronounce. The original subtitle of Herzl's pamphlet was addressed to the Rothschilds. At the height of the Rothschild's power in the 19th century, the family played a pivotal role in world events. Rothschilds financed the British against Napoleon. They helped finance Brazilian independence, and they were instrumental in financing railways and other infrastructure in the world, including the Suez Canal, which is another important part of this story we'll get to in a bit. The Rothschild family was large, though, and it had varied interests and ideas. Some strongly favored Jewish identity, while others had no time for that nonsense, and they just favored assimilation. A few were avid Zionists and even supported religious settlers in Jerusalem for decades. And to these ones, the early Zionists were reaching out and finding support. The word starts to spread, and the first Zionist Congress is called a year after Herzl releases his pamphlet in 1897. The minutes of the Congress tell us a few things that will lay some important groundwork and run as common themes from here on out. See, the official position of the Congress was that the Zionists would only seek to establish, quote, a publicly and legally assured home in Palestine, end quote. The Congress publicly disavowed any idea of desiring an ethnic Jewish state. The distinction between a Jewish home and a Jewish state was absolutely crucial, and they knew it. A struggle over the distinction would determine the character of the Zionist project and the course of history in the Middle East. Herzl was what became known as a political Zionist. In opposition to the official declaration of the Zionist organization that it would only seek a home in Palestine among the Palestinians rather than an ethnic Jewish state, his pamphlet that had led to the Zionist Congress being called in the first place was called Der Judenstaat, the Jewish state. Actually, the literal translation is the Jew state, but that just sounds weird. His pamphlet makes clear that he believed it was imperative to focus their efforts on getting the powers with influence in the region to grant them legal authority over Palestine. Thus obtained, they would then be able to induce Jews from all over the world to immigrate to Palestine, assured that the Ottoman or the British Empire, whoever, guaranteed their sovereignty and security. This is political Zionism. The state is the thing. Borders, a government, a military, recognition in the international community. Then we can worry about other things. Now, in opposition to this perspective were the practical Zionists. Practical Zionists believed that a declaration of a Jewish state, even if it was agreed to by all the powers in the world, was a meaningless gesture on its own and would only provoke the local population to oppose Jewish immigration from the start. The practical Zionists said, who cares about some lines on a map or paper agreements with governments? They took a different approach. Get in there, create an economy, build relationships with people, pave roads, build schools and universities that benefit everybody, create industry, bring investment. Build the Jewish homeland from the inside out, and eventually it won't have to be declared, for it'll simply be a fact. Why provoke the local population over an empty declaration? Eventually, Herzl and the political Zionists were forced to admit that the practical Zionists had a point there. It was too early in the game to start arguing with the Arabs over ownership and sovereignty when the Jews still only made up 3, maybe 4% of the population of Palestine. But while they accepted the strategic necessity of adopting the practical Zionist public stance, the political Zionists remained convinced that a sovereign, ethnically Jewish state had to be the goal. Herzl, writing in his diary after the Congress, explained this realpolitik. Quote, if I were to sum the Congress up in a word, which I shall take care not to publish, it would be this. At Basel I founded the Jewish state. If I said this out loud today, it would be greeted by universal laughter. In 5 years, perhaps, and certainly in 15, everyone will perceive it. End quote. The Jewish state. This is a distinction that means everything, and the Zionists knew it. The United States lets in a lot of immigrants from Mexico, right? How differently would people feel about it if they came in openly expressing their goal of shearing off the Southwest to create their own country? And even most people in favor of full open immigration are going to pump the brakes and say, yo, you can come over, make yourself at home, my house is your house, but if you start demanding that I sign over the deed, I'm going to have a couple questions. And the political Zionists accepted that it was necessary to hide these intentions, not only from the population they would be moving in on, but from the powers whose help or permission they would need, because no one was ready to waste their time and resources enforcing a coerced displacement of a local population to make room for a new Jewish state that may or may not even happen. It's a tough sell to convince one of the great powers to permanently piss off the Arabs by giving an important piece of land to a bunch of European Jews for all you knew. Might get bored with this whole thing once they spent a summer in the Negev desert. And so the narrative had to be crafted in a way that was non-threatening to both the Arabs and the imperial powers the Zionists were asking for help. And so the Zionists pushed the idea that Palestine was an empty, neutral territory, again, as Herzl called it in his manifesto. But as early as the First Congress, and even before that, there were plenty of people calling attention to the fact that that wasn't exactly true. The Jewish tradition is one of the richest troves of literature, poetry, and wisdom in man's possession. It gave birth to Christianity and Islam, whose adherents alone make up over half the world's population today. The dialogue of the Hebrew people and its journey from slavery to liberation and triumph and back down through defeat and exile and destruction is the basis for many of man's most profound meditations. Early in the story, historical circumstances led to the Jewish people finding themselves oppressed and persecuted in a foreign land. They were scattered, living for themselves and their families in the oppressor's land, with hardly any memory or sense of themselves as a distinct nation at all. And then, one day, they were called by a prophet in the name of a deity who claimed to be the god of their fathers. The prophet called on them to remember that they were a people, one people, bound by a covenant with one God, and said that he would lead them to a land that God had chosen for them. They wandered around for decades, facing hunger and hardship, but their identity was forged during the trials of their journey. Finally, when they were ready, they arrived at the outskirts of the Promised Land. They sent in spies to get the lay of the land, but there was a problem. The land was already full of people. But the place had been promised to them, and so through a combination of courage, deception, and divine intervention, the ancient descendants of the Jews obeyed their God's command to conquer the land, cleansing it of any trace of its native population, killing everyone and everything, right down to the cattle, sheep, and donkeys. They laid heavy curses on anyone who dared to rebuild what they had destroyed, forbade mixing with any of the surviving remnant of the native inhabitants, and constantly fought to keep their society free from any of the impurities picked up from the surrounding culture. They built a temple and formed a kingdom, and after fleeing foreign captivity and persecution, the mass of homeless wanderers finally had a place to call their own and had truly become one people. No scholar today would tell you that the events described in that story actually happened, any more than the events described in any other Near Eastern Iron Age myth actually happened, but this is the kind of thing you need if you're going to really fire up a revolutionary. All revolutionaries live on mythology. Reason can justify and rationalize, but emotion motivates. No revolution's ever been sparked, or at least sustained, through reason argument. Mythology is like oxygen to a revolutionary, and that's whether you're talking about Marx's dialectic of history, or God's chosen people, or the return to the promised land. These ideas have power to drive people like no other force. Even rage and desperation burn themselves out pretty quickly and can be bought off. They can start riots, but they can't sustain people through years of hardship, against the odds, and against greater force. Only a story can do that. Only a story that relates each outer context to an inner center and gives everyone a role to play, that gives meaning to their victories and their sufferings, can do that. The Zionists would have to draw on the same spirit that drove their ancient forebears. Because like them, they were seeking to carve out a new nation in a land already occupied by other people. They would have to be guided by the same God who had told their conquering ancestors, quote, "I gave you a land on which you did not toil, and cities you did not build, and you live in them and eat from vineyards and olive groves that you did not plant," end quote. Mythology also played a role, a major role, in how the Europeans approached this situation. You can imagine the Zionists making their case to European Christians who had grown up hearing stories about how God had given this land to the Jews from its native inhabitants. The sacred text of the Jews is the Old Testament of the Christian Bible, so since childhood, these Europeans had been memorizing stories about how the ancient ancestors of the Jewish people were commanded by God, the same God, by the way, that the Christians worshipped, to enter that land and clear it of its native population and take possession of it, and how that land was supposed to belong to the Jews until the end of the world because of a covenant made with Abraham. All their lives they've been hearing that story, and Christian prophecies spoke of the importance of the Jews one day returning to that land and rebuilding the nation of Israel. Some British officials who had become involved in the Zionist effort, they were very specific that their reasons for supporting the cause had a lot to do with all this. And to this day, tens of millions of Americans, which is where this is mostly situated today, believe that they're required to support Israel in all circumstances, no matter what. Celebrity televangelist Pat Robertson said it this way, quote, "Ladies and gentlemen, evangelical Christians support Israel because we believe that the words of Moses and the ancient prophets of Israel were inspired by God. We believe that the emergence of a Jewish state in the land promised by God to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob was ordained by God. Of course, we, like all right-thinking people, support Israel because Israel is an island of democracy, an island of individual freedom, an island of the rule of law, and an island of modernity in the midst of a sea of dictatorial regimes, the suppression of individual liberty, and a fanatical religion intent on returning to the feudalism of 8th-century Arabia. These facts about modern-day Israel are all true, but mere political rhetoric does not account for the profound devotion to Israel that exists in the hearts of tens of millions of evangelical Christians. You must realize that the God who spoke to Moses on Mount Sinai is our God. Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob are our spiritual patriarchs. Jeremiah, Ezekiel, and Daniel are our prophets. King David, a man after God's own heart, is our hero. The holy city of Jerusalem is our spiritual capital. And the continuation of Jewish sovereignty over the Holy Land is a further bulwark to us that the God of the Bible exists and that his word is true. End quote. Mere political rhetoric does not account for it. Now, the early decisions of Europeans in support of Zionism often sprang from the perspective that Robertson just described. And when that's where someone's coming from, there's really no argument to be made about the rights of the Arabs or about our foreign policy interests or any of that nonsense. The land of Palestine belongs to the Jews because God says it does. And no matter what happens, we're required to support Israel and the Jews unconditionally. To these folks, it's a religious duty in a very, very real sense to help bring about and then support the Jewish state. If you're a Palestinian Arab trying to make a case to people who believe that, well, good luck with it. One of the most prominent early Zionists, Chaim Weizmann, he shows why. He was going around saying things like, quote, "There are no English, French, German, or American Jews, but only Jews living in England, France, Germany, or America," end quote. Well, a whole lot of the people he was claiming to speak for were saying, wait a second here, we're not just Jews living in Britain, we're British Jews, and we're proud of it. Get out of here with that stuff. You know, the accusation of the suspicious European anti-Semite was always that the Jew was not really loyal to the country he lived in, but he set himself apart and had an agenda, loyalty, different from the society in which he lived. And many Jews in places like Britain thought that the Zionists were throwing gas on a fire that was well on its way to going out. One of the leading British Jews who opposed the Zionists was a man named Lucian Wolfe. He was an assimilated Jew who considered himself fully British and who considered the Zionist claim that the Jews did not belong in Britain to be just another kind of anti-Semitism. Just as if an Englishman had said that the Jews aren't really British and don't belong in Britain. The Zionists just scoffed at this as a kind of Stockholm syndrome almost, saying that, you know, any Jews hoping for that false dream of assimilation were just in denial of the situation. See, they were trying to pull together a scattered people into a common identity. The Jewish National Fund had been established in 1901 at the Fifth Zionist Congress in order to purchase land in Ottoman Palestine for settlement and development by Jewish immigrants. Now, the fund was endowed. I love this part of the story, by the way. See, the fund wasn't just endowed by, you know, the Rothschilds and the de Hirsches of the world, the big financial dynasties, you know, across Europe, but it was also financed. It had huge support from small donors, individual families, and individual people. And for decades to come, it would be a common sight in Jewish homes all over the world to have this little blue tin box with a map of Israel drawn on it in white, kind of, and change would be dropped in it, and eventually it would fill up, and it would be sent off to the Jewish National Fund to be put to work in Palestine. There was even a children's song, and then I'm going to butcher the rhythm, but here are the lyrics. "The blue box is hanging on the wall, the blue box. Each penny put inside redeems the land. Redeems the land." That's really the theme here. That's something that there really is an idealistic, romantic element underlying the entire thing at this stage of the game. You know, you have people who are bringing together a community that had never died, but it had been sleeping for a thousand years, and trying to bring that back together and return to the home of their ancestral fathers and reclaim it for their people. And not just that, but to revive the spirit of the Jewish nation. You know, this animated these people. It wasn't just about claiming territory and political power. You know, every one of these early meetings and every one of their writings, there's something of this idealism, and you can just feel it as it comes through. Now, but the Jewish National Fund began a new process which would really help determine the character of Zionism and the direction that Zionism would take in Palestine. You see, Theodor Herzl had dreamed of a cosmopolitan, polyglot Jewish state where maybe the primary language was German, and the Jews would be sort of an aristocracy of what was really a colonial state, letting the locals do most of the manual labor and so forth, and allowing the Jewish elite, freeing them up to focus on building income through trade and finance and industry and all the things that they sort of excelled at back in Europe. But some of the Zionists worried about this approach. And it was for two reasons. First, many of them leaned to the political left, even towards socialism or communism. They didn't like to think of themselves as the colonial masters sort of exploiting a native population. But there was also something deeper, and their approach became known as labor Zionism, because it was based on the belief that the Jews could only reestablish the deep connection to the land of their fathers by getting on their knees and working it with their own hands, digging their fingernails into the dirt. Now, the earliest Zionists, they'd been happy to buy up land that had been inhabited by Arab farmers and just collect income by continuing to lease it to whoever lived there before, or at the very least, offering employment to the Arabs that they had displaced. But the labor Zionists, first they felt that this was exploitative, and they didn't want to be another South Africa with a racial elite kind of sitting at the upper crust top of society using this vast underclass of laborers native to the place. They didn't want to do that. That was something that they associated with old Europe and the colonial imperialism and the cultures that they were trying to get away from. And anyway, the Jews, they needed to get down in the dirt themselves. That's what these labor Zionists believed, you know, to really establish that connection to the land of Palestine and Israel again. And so when land was purchased by the Jewish National Fund, it was determined that that land could only be lived on or worked on by Jews. Now, whatever their intentions with that were, it's not surprising that right at this time is when we start to see the first Palestinian Arabs start to take notice of what's going on. The Jews are still only a tiny fraction of the population, and it's just a few Arab intellectuals and political activists for the most part, you know, a couple angry farmers who have been pushed off their land. But this is when we start to first see the little signs of concern start to show up. As the fund began to accumulate land, the offer of resettlement became more and more appealing to some Jewish people for different reasons. Some were just revolutionary Zionists or religious true believers who were just caught up with the idea of returning to the Holy Land and so forth. But for the project to really take root and last, it becomes a sustainable community. You know, the Zionists were going to have to convince regular Jews who lived in Europe and just thought that a new start in Palestine sounded better than whatever they had going on now. By the time we get up to around 1910 or so, a few communities have been established and things seem to be going pretty well, and there are some people who, they might have been skeptical at first, they're at least starting to perk their eyes up and take a look. In Palestine, the Ottoman Turks are still in control, and Jewish immigration, it's not really raising too many alarm bells at this point. There are very few reports of any real problems between the locals and the new arrivals. Partially, this is because the numbers are still relatively small, and because Zionist immigrants are mostly keeping to themselves, reducing any friction with the local population. You've got to remember, even the political Zionists, even the more extreme political Zionists, who had plans to eventually dominate the region politically and set up an exclusively ethnic Jewish state, they knew that it was important to keep a low profile for the time being. They had acquiesced that point to the practical Zionists. North of the Ottoman Empire was another empire on its last legs. The Austro-Hungarian Empire of Central and Southeastern Europe commanded a multi-ethnic society, and calls for national independence grew louder every year as the empire lost its grip. The First World War put all of Europe to the torch, but by the time it was over, neither the Middle East in general nor Palestine in particular would be spared from the flames. When the war broke out, revolutionaries all over Europe saw opportunities. When existing power structures are in the way of your goals, chaos is your friend. The Allies, France, the British Empire, and the Russian Empire, they slam headlong into the German and Austro-Hungarian empires. Within 3 months, millions of men are dead. Countrysides are devastated. Civilians have been ruined. Whole cities are wiped out. And so in November 1914, the Ottoman Empire enters the war against the Allies. Now, the Ottoman Empire was falling apart, and it really brought very little to the table directly to help Germany and Europe. But the Central Powers, they were still happy to have them join the party for one simple reason. The Turks' simple presence in the war applied pressure to Russia's southern territories, and it applied pressure to the colonial possessions that Britain and France held in the Middle East and North Africa, which forced those countries to divert manpower and resources from the European fronts to those other areas to defend them. The British, in particular, had possessions in the Middle East that were under the flag of the Ottoman Empire during its glory days, and the Turks knew that this was the best opportunity they might ever have to get them back. The British had occupied Egypt for decades, and so they controlled the vital Suez Canal connecting the Mediterranean to the Indian Ocean and tying together the two halves of the British Empire. The Ottoman Sultan, which was the closest thing Islam had to a leader of the faith, declares a jihad against the Allies and calls on the Muslims of Egypt to rise in rebellion against the British. Now, I said that the Sultan was the closest thing that Islam has to a leader because there really isn't anyone in the Islamic faith like the Pope is in Roman Catholicism, say. The Ottoman Sultan had a while back absorbed the title of Caliph, so he carried a lot of religious weight, but not everyone was comfortable with the arrangement. Islam was born out of the Arabian desert. The Quran is written in Arabic, and although Islam is a world religion, the Arabs have always had a special relationship to it, and they always will. The Ottoman Empire was run by Turks. It came from the Eurasian steppe. They were converts to Islam, who for centuries now had dominated the entire Muslim and Arab heartland. And so while you had to pay attention while the Sultan was speaking, for sure, he was a powerful guy, controlled a lot of armies, a lot of wealth, there were other Muslim leaders who still carried weight of their own. And one of the most important of these was the Sharif and Emir of the holy city of Mecca, Hussein bin Ali, a descendant of an Arabian clan called the Quraysh. And if that sounds familiar, it should. It's the clan of Islam's founder, the Prophet Muhammad. Well, the war in Europe was a bloodbath, and it wasn't letting up. Meanwhile, the British push against the Ottoman Empire at Gallipoli was going terribly. It was a horrible disaster. And so in 1915, the British reach out to Hussein for help. Hussein was very cautious here. He, like many others, he liked the idea of restoring Arab independence, but the Ottoman Empire wasn't the worst thing in the world as far as foreign overlords went, at least if you were Muslim. The Turks were Muslim themselves, and they allowed their provinces a fair measure of self-government. Hussein was not eager to replace his people's relatively agreeable subordination to the Ottoman Turks with the heavy hand of European colonialism, because everybody knew exactly what that meant. But Hussein also had reason to believe that his family had enemies high in the Ottoman government, and so he used the opportunity to secure promises from the British to support his rule over an independent Arab state after the war. And so, assured that the Arab lands from Syria to Yemen would once again be under Arab independent control, Sharif Hussein rallied his forces in revolt against the Ottoman Empire in June 1916. Now, none of the nations on either side were prepared for the sustained fury that came with the First World War. They were stretching their resources and their people and their industrial capacity to the breaking point, hoping to outlast the other side. And this wasn't a war that was going to be won in a single stroke. It was a war of attrition, and whichever society broke down first, that was the society that was going to lose. By 1915, the first full year of the war, in addition to other shortages, Britain was having a lot of difficulty scraping together enough of a chemical called acetone. It's the active ingredient in nail polish remover and paint thinner, and it was used in the manufacture of something called cordite. Now, cordite is the powder that Britain used in most of its shells, from rifle cartridges to artillery shells and tank rounds and even its heavy naval guns. Well, David Lloyd George, head of the munitions ministry in Britain, was scrambling for answers when Winston Churchill, at the time the First Lord of the Admiralty, the head of the British Navy, heard about a biochemistry lecturer at the University of Manchester who just might be able to help. It was Chaim Weizmann. He was born in Belarus in 1874 and had been educated in Europe before accepting a position at the University of Manchester and becoming a British subject. He was 22 years old when Theodore Herzl released his call to the Jewish people, and he quickly became one of the leaders of Zionism in Britain. While lecturing in Manchester, he had developed a method of deriving acetone through a process of bacterial fermentation, a new process. And when the British government came calling, and asking about his synthetic process, he modified it for mass production, and by 1916, Britain's munitions problem was solved. Wiseman was put in charge of the British Admiralty's labs, and suddenly, an important Zionist leader found himself in regular conversations with prime ministers and cabinet members and generals. See, a lot of people today have this idea that all the crazy ideas about Jews in the first half of the 20th century were just thought up by Adolf Hitler and the Nazis, right? And that makes sense when you hear quotes like this. Quote, "In violent opposition to all this sphere of Jewish effort rise the schemes of the international Jews. This worldwide conspiracy for the overthrow of civilization and for the reconstitution of society on the basis of arrested development, of envious malevolence, and impossible equality has been steadily growing. It has been the mainspring of every subversive movement during the 19th century, and now at last this band of extraordinary personalities from the underworld of the great cities of Europe and America have gripped the Russian people by the hair of their heads and have become practically the undisputed masters of that enormous empire." Oh, wait a second. That wasn't Adolf Hitler. That was Winston Churchill, the head of the British Navy and future prime minister we mentioned a second ago. Mark Sykes was one of the most important British diplomats right at this moment, and he was another one who seemed to believe that the Jews had some kind of almost magical power. He would later warn an Arab prince not to resist the Zionists, telling him, quote, "Believe me when I say this race, despised and weak, is universal, is all-powerful, and cannot be put down," end quote. And he said that Jews had their hands, quote, "in the councils of every state, in every bank, in every business, in every enterprise," end quote. Now, the millions and millions of Jews around the world were not one monolithic body, but Wiseman had convinced some of the most important men in Britain that the Zionists could speak for them. And if Britain wanted the help of this powerful super race of financial and political puppet masters, they would have to help the Zionists. If they believed that an international Jewish conspiracy controlled America's financial markets and were pulling the strings of the Russian Revolution, Wiseman was happy to let them think that. The idea was, look, you want to get the United States more involved in the war more quickly? You want to keep Russia from bowing out? Awful lot of rich and powerful Jews in those two countries. I might be able to make a few phone calls, see what I can do for you. Now, the truth of this was, of course, questionable at best. Of the 3 million Jews in the United States, only 12,000 were members of a Zionist group. Nevertheless, Wiseman made an impression. And the British Foreign Secretary, Arthur Balfour, made the case in a cabinet meeting, saying, quote, "The vast majority of Jews in Russia and America now appear to be favorable to Zionism. If we could make a declaration favorable to such an ideal, we should be able to carry on extremely useful propaganda in both Russia and America," end quote. At this crucial moment, Wiseman decided the time was right to make his play. He warned Lord Balfour that Germany was about to offer to give Palestine to the Jews, and that the Zionists, who had believed all along that Wiseman had been wrong to put his hopes in Britain, that they might have been right. He told them that Jewish people around the world were increasingly beginning to question, quote, "whether they were to realize their aims through Turkey and Germany or through Great Britain," end quote. And so at cabinet meetings in October 1917, British ministers huddled together to discuss this possibility, and they came out with a decision. Afraid that the power of the international Jews would swing over to support Germany, they decided to seize the initiative and make a public declaration of support for the Zionist project. And so instructions were given to Wiseman to have his colleagues draft the wording of the declaration for issue by the British government. A short letter from the British Foreign Secretary to the British Zionist Baron Rothschild, it's come down to us as the Balfour Declaration. This one-page document is the scrap of paper that gave birth to a nation if you're a Zionist, or else it's theft, betrayal, and an injustice if you're an Arab, especially a Palestinian. Either way, it was the document that would lock Britain into enforcing a contradictory policy and begin a cycle of violence and chaos and terror that's still spinning as I speak to you now. The British would have had a steadfast ally in the Arabs after supporting their bid for independence, so defense of the Suez probably wasn't a primary factor. So why would they do this? Why would the British help build a hornet's nest and then stick their own faces in it? Well, there were a few hardcore Zionist supporters in the British government, Christian Zionists, guys like Lloyd George and Balfour, who had supported the Zionists for a long time and were committed to the project ideologically. Churchill was another one. The Zionists also knew that most British officials, they only thought they were supporting Jewish immigration and settlement in Palestine, and they would never commit themselves to what it would take to create and support a Jewish state. Wiseman said as much when he told his friends who were writing the Balfour Declaration to practice, quote, safe statesmanship, by not mentioning publicly that their final ideal was a Jewish state. His friend, Harry Socker, wasn't as cautious, and he wrote a draft that would have asked the British government to support, quote, the reconstitution of Palestine as a Jewish state and as the national home of the Jewish people, end quote. Well, Wiseman was out of the country, attempting to undermine efforts toward peace between Turkey and the United States at the time, but fortunately others were there to rein in Socker and word the declaration in less threatening terms. In the end, they settled on a statement declaring that the British would support the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people, to the extent that such efforts would not infringe in any way upon the rights of the local population. Well, it turned out that Wiseman and many other Zionists thought the message was too cautious. Wiseman himself objected to the inclusion of language about protecting the rights of existing non-Jewish communities. Well, as you can imagine, the Ottoman Empire made sure the leaders of the Arab revolt got their hands on the Balfour Declaration as soon as possible. And, as you can imagine, Hussein bin Ali had some questions. At the exact same time that the Balfour Declaration was being drafted and published, Arab soldiers were engaged against the Ottomans liberating Sinai and Palestine. And they were more than a little concerned about the possibility that they had just been dying on the battlefield to conquer Palestine for a group of Jews who still lived in Europe. The British dispatched messengers to reassure the Arabs that nothing had changed with regard to our previous agreement, everything's fine, nothing to worry about. But before they even had time to process the implications of the Balfour Declaration, the Arabs got hit with another surprise. A month after the declaration was published, the revolutionary government in Russia released a document which outlined a secret agreement between Britain, France, and the former Russian government to divide up the Middle East after the war was over. The Sykes-Picot Agreement. It was negotiated in 1916, around the same time that the British were making promises to the Arabs to get them to fight against the Turks. The idea was to leave a local Arab ruler in charge, nominally, but to ensure that he was merely a puppet. So far, they had promised Palestine to the Arabs in return for their support against the Turks. They had promised it to the Zionists in return for the support of the great and powerful forces of the international Jew. And they had promised northern Palestine to the French while committing the rest to an international administration. And finally, they had engaged in negotiations with the Ottoman Turks to explore the possibility of leaving the whole area back to them in exchange for a separate peace. Now, the question is who the British were lying to. Most people today tend to assume that the Sykes-Picot Agreement made with the French showed Britain's only real intentions, while everything else was just a deception. The truth is that the British were lying to everybody, including the French. So the British were making promises to the French without telling them about the promises they had made to the Arabs. Meanwhile, you've got the Arabs fighting against the Turks in exchange for the promise of independence, and then you've got Wiseman and others in Europe using Zionist money and influence to make sure they get what they want when the smoke clears. And what they want is a piece of the property the British had just promised to the people living in it. As the war finally came to an end and the parties came to the table in Paris to discuss the terms of the peace, the French, the Zionists, and the Arabs all arrived expecting that the end of the war meant that they would finally get what they had been working and fighting for. For the British, the day of reckoning had arrived. Millions and millions of French soldiers and civilians had been killed or wounded in the war, and they were not in the mood to make concessions. As far as they were concerned, whatever promises the British had made to others, the Sykes-Picot Agreement took precedent, and the French claimed the right to Syria, Lebanon, and northern Iraq. And the Arabs were saying to the British, look, we took sides with you against a Muslim empire that really wasn't that bad to live under to fight for our independence. And independence is what we expect to get. In any case, we're talking about Arab lands, so how can the claims of the French or anyone else take precedence over us? And then there were the Zionists, standing on a table and waving the Balfour Declaration in the air. Behind the scenes, Ben-Gurion ridiculed those who thought that there was any room at all for compromise between the Jews and the Arabs. He told one Jewish committee, quote, everybody sees a difficulty in the question of relations between the Jews and Arabs, but not everybody sees that there is no solution to this question. No solution. There is a gulf, and nothing can bridge it. I do not know what Arab will agree that Palestine should belong to the Jews. We as a nation want this country to be ours. The Arabs as a nation want this country to be theirs. End quote. There were others who were even more frank than that. Moshe Chertok, who would be Ben-Gurion's kind of right-hand man over the next several years, and who would eventually be Israel's first foreign minister, he had an even sharper edge than Ben-Gurion. A bit earlier than this, he had written, quote, we have forgotten that we have not come to an empty land to inherit it, but we have come to conquer a country from a people inhabiting it, that governs it by virtue of its language and savage culture. Recently, there have been appearing in our newspapers the clarification about, quote, the mutual misunderstanding between us and the Arabs, and, quote, common interests, and about, quote, the possibility of unity and peace between the two fraternal peoples. But we must not allow ourselves to be deluded by such elusive hopes, for if we cease to look upon our land, the land of Israel, as ours alone, and we allow a partner into our state, all content and meaning will be lost to our enterprise, end quote. Now, when one of the most important Palestinian Zionist leaders is writing that, it becomes pretty clear that the Arabs probably aren't being paranoid enough. In the last 7 years, the Arabs of Palestine have just been just smashed. Over and over and over, they've been smashed. Years of oppression, war, plague, and starvation. With a third of their population dead after the war, and the rest traumatized beyond measure, they think they've outlasted the disaster and they're ready to move forward, only to have the French and the British come in and tear apart their hopes for independence. And now for 3 years since the First World War ended, they've watched the Zionists flood into their country, loudly announcing their intention to take it over. You know, there are people who will say, almost as a dogma, almost no matter what, that violence is never justified. That whoever throws the first punch in any fight is always in the wrong. Well, it's hard for me to go through the history of the conflict between the Jews and the Arabs and pretend that things are that simple. You know, if you're a father or a mother and your children are in mortal danger, what would you do to get them to safety? Would you hurt someone else to protect the ones you love? I hope that you never have to make that decision, but that's exactly the decision the Zionists were facing. If you were a Jewish person living in Europe or Russia, this danger was palpable. It was real. Dead children and raped wives and mothers were not just bad dreams. They were something real that you had to think about every time you locked your doors and went to sleep at night. How far would you go to keep your children from being murdered or your wife from being raped? The great tragedy of human life is that we sacrifice the people we could be to the people that we have to be.
Go check out the Martyr Made podcast. You can find it on most platforms or go straight to martyrmade.com.
In a world veiled in mystery and driven by the quest for the impossible, join Alex on a transformative journey through the arcane art of transmutation. From ancient practices to the birth of modern science, we will uncover the secrets and stories of history's most enigmatic philosophers. The Natural Born Alchemist podcast presents a series that explores the trials, triumphs, and mystical pursuits of alchemy, the original quest for wisdom and power. Be sure to subscribe and unlock the vault of forgotten knowledge. Don't miss a single episode of this detailed telling of the history of alchemy, where we turn the leaden pages of history into podcast gold.
All right, that's it for this episode. Please follow Twitter, Born Alchemist, Rumble, YouTube, Natural Born Alchemist. Just search the term and you'll find it. See you soon, hopefully. Freedom is in the mind.